Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist from the 1st of September 2018. This is the editorial article, and this is basically a cognitive rehab where I sort of extend myself reading, and hopefully bits of my brain gets back together. Nature's in our hands. This is an editorial. Can we stop the destructive side of evolution? But should we? We can stop it, but should we? What kind of force is evolution? You may see it as malevolent, benevolent, or both, but chances are you'll also think of it as monumental, long-term, and large-scale. Over billions of years, evolution has created life on Earth, from giraffes' necks to an ape's clever enough to contemplate how life evolves. Yet evolution can also be fast and furious. It's happening right here, right now, and it threatens the very future of civilization. This is evolution of superbugs. I get it's interesting how you actually do evolution underneath your armpits. The evolution explains the resurgence of the pests we thought were under control, including cockroaches and bedbugs. It undermines food security and is jeopardizing modern medicine. It has been happening since the dawn of civilization, but as we change the world ever more rapidly, our arms race with evolution escalates. We have long sought ways to keep one step ahead. Now we have reached a crucial moment. We're developing the tools to halt evolution in its tracks. At the core of so basic CRISPR, the CRISPR gene drive, at the core of the new toolkit is a gene editing technology. The technology called CRISPR, clustered regularly interspaced palindromic repeats, has already been used to reverse antibiotic resistance in the lab, and there are plans to try to approach in hospitals. CRISPR could also stop unwanted mutations happening at all, such as anti-evolution superweapon might find roles in food manufacturing to prevent microbes used in large batch fermenters losing their potency. They could even prevent wild plants and animals from evolving undesirable traits. Taking control of evolution sounds enticing, but there's surely be unintended consequences. If there is one thing we know for sure, it is that evolution always finds a way. There's a huge opportunity here, but there's also risks. We need to have a conversation about this technology and decide how we want to proceed. It's also, I want to start the conversation. It means that I really want to bash you up. Here's the second editorial. Fake videos created by artificial intelligence, known as deepfakes, are becoming incredibly convincing. They show people saying or doing things they would never said or did. And recent technological leaks have made producing realistic ones easier than ever, page 5. Although having fakes masquerade as a genuine article is a risk, it may not be the main problem. Instead, it could be that with such convincing fakes around, it could be easy for someone to falsely dispute the authenticity of the real deal. A stark illustration of this can be found in the US, where the position of a computer-generated image of a child sexual abuse is treated more leniently by courts than the real thing. This has resulted in the rise of virtual defense, claiming illicitly images are actually computer-generated. Similarly, in politics, when people are faced with something they disagree with, an increasingly common attack is to ride it as fake news. The only way to fight back is to find sources of information you can trust. If you think spotting fakes is hard, try spotting reals. I think science is overall just steps ahead. This week, again, with no authors for it. Ebola death rate rises. There's been a sudden uptick in the deaths caused by Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo, beating the number of people killed in the current outbreak up to 75. In an update on the 26th of August, the World Health Organization reported 111 cases of hemorrhage fever, which cause vomiting, diarrhea, and in some cases internal bleeding. Of these, 83 are confirmed cases and 28 are probable. That is more than double the numbers in the previous outbreak in the western part of the DRC, which was declared over in June 2018. So far, 13 have been reported amongst health workers, including one death. Of the deaths so far, 47 are confirmed to be due to Ebola, and 28 are deemed to be probable. The WHO response to the outbreak has been complicated by the fact that the epicentre, North Kivu Province, is instead in conflict and contains armed militia. It's also one of the country's most populated regions, shares a border with Rwanda and Uganda, making it more urgent to contain the outbreak. 5 experimental therapies have been approved for use in the region in an attempt to halt Ebola's spread and to catch it. Also improve the survival rate of those who catch it. This includes an antibody known as MAB114, which is isolated from a woman who survived in 1995 Ebola outbreak. It's currently been tested on clinical trials. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the WHO Director General, celebrated the first 2 Congolese patients to receive an antibody and recover, calling it a global first, a ray of hope for people with the disease. Again, no author. Pollution linked to cognitive decline. Bloody hell. Breathing polluted air may make people worse at maths and damage their language skills. Analysis was compared with the local air quality, with the cognitive test scores of nearly 32,000 students in China has found that 17% increase in the measure of air pollution is linked with a 6% decrease in their verbal skills and 2% decrease in their mathematical performance. Air pollution may damage the brain through several pathways. Xiao Biao Zhang of Peking University in Beijing, who involved in analysis. Other researchers have shown that the pollutants in the air can carry toxins into the brain. Increased oxygen supply caused by pollution may impair cognitive function, and prolonged exposure to unclean air can lead to neurological inflammation and disease. The team calculated that lowering the air pollution in China to levels recommended in the US would raise the verbal test score by 13% and the math skills by 3.7%. That's amazing. Facebook bans top military chief. Facebook has banned Myanmar's military commander-in-chief, Min Aung Hlaing, pictured from the platform as part of its commitment to tracking the spread of hate speech. The company has removed 17 other individuals associated with Myanmar's military. Quote, "We want to prevent them from using our service to further inflame ethnic and religious tensions," confirms it in statements. The move follows the release of a report on Monday by the UN Human Rights Council, which declared that top military generals in Myanmar should be investigated and prosecuted for war crimes and genocides in the country's minority Rohingya population. The report also referenced Facebook activity, including posts stating that, quote, "race cannot be swallowed by the ground, but only by another race." The removal of top army officials in Myanmar is an unprecedented move for Facebook, marking the first time it has banned a country's military or political leaders. Home abortions to begin in England. Women in England will soon be able to have abortions in the home if they are less than 10 weeks pregnant. Home abortions were introduced in Scotland and Wales last year, and the UK government has said this will be legalised in England before the end of the year. Medical abortions during the first 9 weeks of pregnancy involve taking 2 lots of medicines over a day or two. Currently, women in England have to take both doses in a clinic under the medical supervision and then leave the clinic after the second pill for it to take effect at home. Because some women start experiencing cramping and bleeding on the journey home, charities such as British Pregnancy Advisory Centre and UK Abortion Provider have long been campaigning for home abortions to be legalised. On the 25th of August, the UK Department of Health and Social Care announced that under the new system, women will be allowed to take the second pill at home if they prefer. Page 5, How to Fake the Real World, by Chris Baranuk. "You need very little to make a credible quite deep fake video," says Chris Baranuk. "A fake is only as good as it looks. And while forging counterfeit handbag or watch takes time and effort, churning out fake videos is surprisingly easy. The new system can turn a few simple animated line drawings into realistic fake clips in high definition. The software is open source, meaning it's available to anyone. It has reignited concerns that such tools could be used to warp our perception of the world. A team at graphics hardware firm Nevada and Massachusetts Institute of Technology has created the system, which uses a generative adversarial network, a type of artificial intelligence. To great effect, the AI first breaks down the rear video into component layers such as foreground and background, and key elements like buildings and trees. This provides a basic editable structure onto which a fake element can be added. One part of the AI then generates frames for the new video sequence based on basic sketches, while other attempts to distinguish the generated frame for the real video frames. If it can't tell them apart, those new frames are judged good enough and are inserted into the synthesized video. The resulting footage can be produced at 2K resolution and looks startlingly lifelike. Examples the team has produced included street scenes and people taking on performance dance moves. Quote, "It's sort of stunning the progress that has been made," says digital forensic expert Hanny Farad of Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. This type of video has become known as a deep fake, and fake videos of the world leaders such as Donald Trump and Theresa May have created using similar techniques. A community dedicated to creating fake pornography videos containing famous actors has sprung up too. The technology to create deepfakes has largely been private or produced cartoonish results, says Berlin-based artist programmer Gene Kogan. That's now changed. Will the latest system be used to convince us that the politicians said something they didn't? For instance, distinguish real videos from fake ones is now a significant problem, Farad said. But he thinks informed fact-checkers are still likely to be able to detect fakes for some time to come. However, damage can still be done while this checking takes place. Fake videos also exhibit some telltale signs. Bogus videos of politicians can be detected by checking whether the individual blinks often enough to be real, for example. Knowing such videos exist could make make people more comfortable discounting things that are in fact real. Quote, "That in some ways is the real threat," said Farad, "that we don't believe anything anymore. One example of this is in the US, where people caught with images of sexual abuse of children have claimed that it was computer generated, known as the virtual defense. Persisting such generated image is still a crime, but it comes at the shortest ends. However, there are many legitimate uses of the technologies. For example, same principles can be used to synthesize architectural designs under after supplying a system with a basic sketch of a building, which could be helpful for designers, or celebrities could, quote, license their faces for use in video advertising without having to actually present filming. Sabbatical real harm. Fake videos have been implicated in the deaths of more than 20 people in India. This started after a video clip showing two men on a motorcycle snatching children on the street went viral on WhatsApp. The video was originally a public service announcement in Pakistan to raise awareness of human trafficking. However, it was edited to remove the message at the end. The clip, though real and widely spread WhatsApp messages, pointed out the finger that organ thieves disguised as speakers, with sparked public outrage leading to mob killings. Even though the producing high-definition fake videos is becoming easier to the main story, these fakes were grainy and low-quality. In India, in excess of 200 million people use WhatsApp, and some regularly forward messages to many contacts, much as people post on social media. As Facebook and Twitter, this process can lead to the spreading of false information. To counteract the phenomenon, WhatsApp has published educational and ads in newspapers in India, and has made it more difficult to forward media to many contacts. This is by Ivan Yee. This is in the news and technology section. Royal waste makes mole rats maternal. Now, what I was going to say is mole rats are the things that I don't think they don't age or something like that. They don't catch cancer. An active role mat queen relies on her colony to help raise her pups. And it turns out that she may manipulate their parenting instincts through hormones hidden in her feces, exploiting the fact that colony members readily eat her waste. The next Royal Mac colonies, the queen is the only reproducing female. She needs other colony members to help look after the pups. Kazutaka Moki of Zunu University, Japan, and his colleagues wanted to know whether the pregnant queen could influence parental instincts in other colony members. They studied the colony and found that the queen's oestrogen levels were highest during gestation. Those of other colony members. This may prime them to care for the pups after birth. Malky and his team wondered whether the hormones spread from the queen to the other colony members through her feces. Many animals eat feces as a way to extract nutrients from their food that they might have missed the first time round. Exploring the idea, Moggy and the team made food pellets of either banana, oatmeal, or feces from the pregnant queen and offered them to the female colony members. They found that oestradiol, a form of estrogen, was transferred when the mole rats dined on the queen's feces. The researchers also tested how dining on the queen's feces affected communal parenting behaviour. Moggy and his team placed the female colony members in a box with a tube on each end and played a recording of the pup's calls to the speakers hidden at the ends of one tube. The mole rats were most attentive to the calls just after the queen had given birth. They entered the tube with the speaker more quickly and spent more time searching for the pup. Moggy and his team members proposed that the queen's raised oestrogen levels during gestation trickle down to the colony and influence parental behaviour of those helping raise the pups. It's not a demonstration of such a mechanism, but it raises a very interesting possibility that they might have some way to prime other individuals in the group for a time when the pups are in need, says Marcus Zotti at the University of Cambridge. But Zotti questions whether the queen could produce enough ways to feed the entire colony, which he says contains as many as 60 members. Chris Fox of Queen Mary University London agrees that it would be unlikely that the pregnant queen's feces could make its way through the entire burrow. Quote, I'd have to be coming out like a machine gun fire to get around the whole colony, he says. Bit of a question, what's going on? by Lee Crane. That was by Chelsea White, by Lee Crane. Our eyes can see images that don't exist. You don't have to directly see an object to perceive it. Computers can create an image of an object just from a series of checkerboard-like patterns of light shone on it without ever directly taking its picture. Now it seems that likely that your eyes do the same. Understanding how your eyes build up an image from a simple pattern of light could help us gain deeper insights into the brain's visual cortex. Ghost imaging is an unusual way of creating a picture. Light in a series of different checkerboard-like patterns is bounced off an object and then collected in a bucket detector that simply records the total brightness of reflected light without collecting any information about the spatial dimensions of the object. When the patterns are stacked with their intensity set by the measurements of the bucket detector, they build an image of the object. It's like a cooking recipe. The locations of the squares of light and darkness in the checkerboard of light patterns tells you the ingredients of the objects being imaged. And the intensity measures tells you how much of each ingredient needs to be added. Then a computer mixes the right amount of each pattern following the recipe to create the final image. But Dan Volker of the University of Glasgow in the UK and his colleagues have now found that at least part of the process of a computer may not be necessary. Your eyes can create an image from patterns with no additional help. To demonstrate this, the researchers took a weighted patterns, all the ingredients of the right amounts, and projected them one after another on a screen. They then increased the speed that patterns flipped from one to the next, until the five volunteers' viewers said they could see the intended images. A photo of Albert Ellenstein. If you project them quickly, then the eye can't follow these changes and everything just blurs together and your brain naturally integrates the patterns to one, says Falcon. As you increase the speed, you went from seeing random patterns to all of a sudden seeing the object emerging. That would be fascinating to see. I'd love to see it. This is similar how the eye can combine movie frames to see a continuous image, says Rebecca Holmes of Los Alamos Laboratory, New Mexico. This may provide a new way to study how our eyes and brains integrate visual information and how fast they do so, says David Irwin of the University of Illinois. Now, how these people are related, but they're just quoted nonetheless. And this is by Else Klein. Mind reading game boosts attention levels for 20 minutes in. I've got to get rich now. Children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, may be able to learn to focus better by playing video games that is controlled by their minds. Zen Zhou at the Duke's NUS Medical School in Singapore and their colleagues have made a game called Gogoland, which the players control the screen and avatar with their minds. To do this, they wear a headband fitted with electroencephalogram EEG sensors and monitors the electrical brain activity. The machine learning algorithm interprets the EEG signal and sets the players to mentally guide the avatar around the screen. The game works by rewarding concentration. For example, when the headband detects the player is focusing harder, the avatar can run faster and collect more tokens. This feedback should mean the game can help and reinforce the concentrating behavior more than regular video games, says Zhou. Concentration problems from common among the children of ADHD. Stimulant drugs like Ritalin and Adderall do help some people, but they can cause side effects like insomnia and moodiness. Zhou and her colleagues have now tested the game on 18 children with ADHD. The participants played Cocolands for 30 minutes 3 times a week. After 8 weeks, the participants showed greater improvements in attention tests than a comparison group of 11 children with ADHD who didn't play the video game. I really dislike the way this is done. Because you really need to test and see the onset improvement. The improvement seemed to correlate with changes in the brain activity. Scans revealed that the children who benefited most from the game exhibited the greatest activity changes in their brain's attention processing network. Sue's team is now evaluating the game in a larger clinical trial, obviously, with children. We dream under general anesthetic, a story by Rowan Hooper. The nightmare scenario of patients undergoing surgery is that they remain aware but are paralyzed and are sliced open. Anesthesia almost always prevents this, but we don't know how it works or how it affects our consciousness. What's more, because our general anesthetic also includes amnesia, it may be difficult to investigate the effect of asking people to recount their experience of it. To get around the problem, Kjartan Valle, a neuroscientist at the University of Stolf in Skövde in Sweden, and her colleagues infused volunteers with anesthetics and roused them at different points during the process to ask them what they had been experiencing. It turns out the consciousness isn't completely lost during anesthesia. Many patients recall having been dreaming despite the received wisdom that proper dreaming only occurs in REM sleep. Quote, anesthesia could resemble normal sleep more than we have previously thought, says Vali. Moreover, the team found the words spoken to people under general anesthetic were processed by the brain, although the subjects had no memory of them afterwards. This means anesthesia does not require complete unconsciousness to work. Vali's team dosed 23 student volunteers with a drug called dexmedetomidine and a further 24 with propofol, the anesthetic ill-fatedly used by Michael Jackson, until they were unresponsive. The group then roused the students and asked them a series of questions about the experience while under the influence of drugs. Most volunteers roused with the anesthetics reporting having dreams. Quote, I remember digging a hole, said one student of his dream. Quote, at the same time I was dreaming, I had a feeling I was lying in bed preparing for the experiment. The levels that they used in the study were lower than those used in surgery. The experiment shows that patients sanitized to the point of behavioral unresponsiveness may be dreaming like and susceptible to waiting. In other words, the boundary between wakefulness and unresponsiveness is more fluid than appreciated. Valley says the results carry an important message, quote, people should not be afraid to undergo anesthesia. She says, this is because the dreams that the volunteers were internally generated or disconnected consciousness experiences. Quote, general anesthesia causes profound disconnectedness, meaning that the patient does not have an awareness of self or the environment or the operation that is going on, says Varley. Quote, no pain is experienced, nor can patients hear what's happening to them in the operating room. Consciousness is not really a binary phenomenon, says Jeremy Slade, anesthesiologist at the University of Auckland, New Zealand. Quote, there is increasingly evidence that general anesthetic drugs can preferentially disrupt very specific brain mechanisms required for perception, memory, and responsiveness. Because this can leave the patient in an odd dissociated state that is simultaneously both awake and asleep, Slade suggests that we should understand the effect of anesthesia as a progressive loss of selfhood rather than a loss of consciousness. That's lovely. I think that's a lovely story. This is a article by Chelsea White, 1st December. Arctic crew wasn't doomed by lead. That's the Franklin expedition. Mystery still surrounds the infamous Franklin expedition, a British voyage set out in 1845 to map the Northwest Passage. The crew went missing in the Canadian Arctic, for some of their remains show evidence of cannibalism. But a big question lingers. What would make those sailors leave the relative safety of their two icebound ships and trek into the unforgiving wilderness? One idea from the 80s suggested lead from the ship's water pipes and food tins leached out and poisoned the sailors, clouding their judgment, but a growing body of evidence showed that lead poisoning is unlikely to have been a factor. The latest addition comes from an analysis of the hair of the crew of one member, tentatively identified as Harry Goodsir, who was buried in King William's Island. Quote, because the hair is inert, whatever trace elements or chemical signatures that is there will stay in the hair, says Laurie D'Rosento of McMaster University in Canada. D'Rosento used a bundle of 55 hair fibres that were found stuck to gold hair's clothes. She and her colleagues washed the hair fibres to eliminate contamination and used a microscope to identify the root of each hair so they could work out which way it had been growing. Researchers then cut it into 3 1-centimetre long segments from each hair beginning at the root. On average, human hair grows at 1 centimetre per month. So the researchers had a record of the hair growth in the final 3 months of gold hair's life. They analysed these segments for lead 205, which is found in the solder used in the seals, the food cans, and the ships, and also in the bodies of 3 crew members buried in Beechey Island in the Canadian Arctic. D'Ozenzo and her team found lead concentrations up to 84.2 parts per million in the oldest hair segments, with the levels lowering to 73.3 near the root. They estimate that these correspond to blood levels between 53.6 and 61.3. Keith Miller at the University of Glasgow says the results make sense. The lead levels are high, but those were for most people in 19th century Britain through the dietary exposure. As such, he says, lead probably didn't cause poisoning. That would cloud the crew's judgment. Jindy Christian, founder of a tissue analysis firm, Trianalytics, had previously examined the fingernail of the Franklin crew member, John Harnell, who is buried in Beechey Island. She says she found even lower levels of the lead. Quote, I agree that lead poisoning wasn't the main cause of death, but I think even these numbers are overestimated, she says. Christian points out that the hair is porous, so it absorbs lead from the general environment. So, what went wrong with the expedition? Miller thinks they were just unlucky. Conditions in the Arctic were unusually bad in the mid-1840s, and they were unprepared. Yogurt breathing may slow your brain waves. Claire Wilson. Okay, a different author. Slow nasal breathing is often helpful forms of yoga or medication. Now we may know why. Such breathing seems to moderate our brain waves. When large groups of nerve cells in the brain fire together, they form brain waves. While the function of them is unclear, their frequency tends to reflect how awake and alert we feel. The slowest during deep sleep, the fastest when we're awake and concentrating. Andrew Zaccaro at the University of Pisa, Italy, wondered if breathing style used in some meditation could affect them. Inside the nasal passages are nerve cells that are exposed to the air, which react to physical force. Sakara's group previously showed that when people who have air puffed into their noses at the slow rhythm, brain waves cross part of the brain slime. You get the same frequency over a vast number of cortical areas, says Sakara. Now the team has found that the slow breathing through the nose may have a similar effect. They asked 16 yoga practitioners to do 15 minutes while taking 2.5 breaths a minute, either through the nose or mouth. And the volunteers filled in the questionnaires used to assess the different aspects of consciousness so the team could judge the meditative state achieved. While researchers didn't look at the brainwaves in the studies, they found that people who carried out nasal breathings were more likely to report introspection and altered consciousness, and typical of meditative state. Previous studies have shown brainwaves are slower in this state. Sakara presented the findings of the Federation of Neuroscience Societies in Berlin. However, it is possible this placebo effect, because the volunteers knew they were breathing through their nose and that this was the right way to do yoga. Oh dear, it's a very low deal. Article, very low science in that one. Black holes born of freak space waves. Simulated collision between two unusual gravitational waves. This is extremely unlikely. Okay, but this is written by Lee Crane. A kind of freakish gravitational wave could be so powerful it could tangle space-time from a black hole and destroy Earth. But don't worry, it probably won't. Most gravitational waves ripple in the fabric of the universe caused by the motion of massive objects. Are spherical. They propagate like 3D versions of ripples on the surface of a pond after a stone is thrown in. But when a high-energy object or particle moves at the speed of light, theory says it creates a different type of gravity wave, a flat, plane-fronted wave, like a tidal wave. Franz Pretorius at Princeton University in New Jersey and William East at the Perimeter Institute in Theoretical Physics in Canada simulated what happens if two of those unusual waves collide. Smaller varieties simply pass through each other and go on to dissipate, but when they get large enough, the pair colliding waves can collapse into a black hole. Pretorius and East found, quote, these particles have a lot of energy and produce a curvature of space-time, and when the waves collide, the curvature wraps on itself, says Pretorius. The black hole left behind would devour about 85% of the energy of the waves, the pair found. Most of the remaining energy would stream outwards in a shell of slightly weaker gravitational waves, while a small portion of the wave be essentially caught in orbit, circling the black hole forever. This is the same sort of theoretical black hole that was posited and sparked scare stories before the Large Hadron Collider and the border between France and Switzerland was switched on for the first time. The collider accelerates particles close to the speed of light and clashes them together. The process would create a plane-fronted gravitational waves and then black holes. But the teams don't have anywhere near enough, the beings don't have anywhere near enough energy. You need an accelerator bigger than the size of the solar system to do this, says Garnwinkel of Oatlands University in Michigan. Quote, there's nothing we know in our universe that could cause plane-fronted waves of high enough energy to form black hole. The gravitational waves that the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, detected as a result of the merger of black holes stretched and squeezed the 4-kilometer detectors about 1,000th the width of the proton in contrast. Pretorius says the freak waves used simulation would walk LIGO more than a kilometer or more. You wouldn't want such a wave to be nearby, and if it were, it would stretch the Earth by thousands of kilometres and everything would be destroyed, says Vitor Cruzo of the University of Lisbon, Portugal. As soon as we learned about it, we would die. This article by Lee Crane, same article, same author. Wood plumped full of gel could make muscles. To make an artificial muscle, you need a material with both strength and flexibility. A new gel-infused wood does the trick and could someday be used to implant muscles or external prosthetics. To create the material, Liebong Ho of the University of Maryland and his colleagues started with a block of wood. The structure of wood with its strong, aligned fibers is similar to the underlying organization of muscles. Hugh and his colleagues submerged the wood in bleach to remove its lichen, a compound that provides its rigidity, leaving behind only the cellulose fibres to form the wood grain. Then they fill the resulting gaps with hydrogel, the same water-soaked polymer that is used to make soft contact lenses. This made the material flexible and stretchy. The mixture was cured to 60 degrees to bond the hydrogel to the cellulose skeleton, resulting in a cloudy, white gel with the strength of wood but the flexibility of gel. Though weaker than solid wood, in the direction parallel to the wood grain, it's about 80 times stronger than skeletal muscles. As with muscle tissue, the alignment of fibres makes it harder to tear if you pull along the grain. To test whether the material was biocompatible and thus able to be implanted into the human body, the researchers cultured embryonic kidney cells on it and found that the cells adhered and grew over the course of 2 days. They found that liquids carrying ions like sodium and potassium could flow through the wood gel just as they do through muscle tissues and body to enable signalling. This material is biocompatible and biodegradable. It can potentially be used to artificial muscle and culture prosthetics. My problem is, how does it actually act as a muscle? I don't quite understand that. Special glass made ancient cities gleam. This is interesting. About 1,000 by Andy Coghlan. About 1,200 years ago, ancient architects in the city of Sumara in what is now Iraq built a spectacular glass palaces, the largest most ever seen in the Islamic world. Now, chemists have discovered that the glass differs from that found almost anywhere else in the ancient world. They produce a colourless glass free of coloured tints simply by using very clean silica source, which makes this group of glasses exceptional for the time, says Nadine Scribe, the University of Orleans in France. She and her colleagues analysed 265 glass objects excavated and collected from Samarra, which lies 125 kilometres north of Baghdad between AD 836 and 892. It served as the seat of the Abbasid Caliphate, the third to rule the Islamic world following the death of the Prophet Muhammad in 632. Half the rocks comprised everyday glass objects, including bowls, plates, bottles. The rest consisted of coloured colourless fragments and architectural glass that was incorporated into the fabric of buildings, including size large palaces as windows, floors, inlays. The glass was made available to Schindler's team by the British Museum and the Victorian Albert Museum, both in London, and by Berlin's Museum of Islamic Art. For the analysis, Schiebel's team removed tiny fragments from each artifact, set them in a resin, polished them to remove any contamination, and then put them in a mass spectrometer and reveal a chemical fingerprint. In antiquity, most ancient glasses were made and supplied by the Romans or by skilled glassmakers living in Egypt and the Levant in the eastern Mediterranean. These glassmakers mix silica-rich sands with natron, which is from which is the glass, from the natron area in Egypt, which is sodium hydroxide, lime basically, a form of hydrated soda ash. There you go. Melted the two together for several weeks to make molten glass. Natron, this is where Na from sodium hydroxide, the Na of natron. Natron lowered the melting temperature. Many of the objects excavated tonight were made in this way and had probably been imported from Egypt and Levant. But the architectural glass was different. Natron had been replaced with soda-rich ash from burnt plants. In 3.5% of the weight, these architectural glasses contained up to 3 times the amount of magnesium oxide found in natural glass. This chemical signature was common to samples of architectural glass and so distinct from the natron-based glasses that Schiebel and her colleagues concluded that the architectural glass must have been custom-made locally in amounts large enough to adorn Sade's Paris. They say there is support for this idea of ancient scripts. A nearby town called Al-Quisiyada has described the 13th century as the glassworks. Oh, Ian Freestone of the University College of London says the results are important for revealing more about the early ceramic glass industry, as you would want to know. Could stupidity save us from the AI apocalypse? Artificial intelligence. Maybe we need artificial stupidity instead. In order to avoid apocalyptic scenarios where machines take over the world, there some suggest we should limit the AI to human-level intelligence. Although artificial general intelligence, AI, that can perform any task that a human brain can, don't yet exist. Planning how to limit their abilities and make them behave in ways that are familiar to humans may help avert disaster in the future. Roman Yampolsky, this is by Chris Banyurik, he's written another article, at the University of Louisville, Kentucky, and Michael Tassi of the Sorbonne University of Paris, suggests constraining AI by introducing artificial stupidity, using rough estimates of the storage space brain with the processing power of the human brain. They propose capping the number of operations per second and restricting the capacity of AI's working memory to comparable levels to the human brain. However, as humans might not use their processing power optimally, an AI could start smartest even if it carries out fewer operations per second. So, the pair suggests two further measures. Ensure the AI isn't able to self-improve to make itself more efficient, and to give it human-like cognitive biases, mistakes in reasoning, often made because deeply held belief that mean we dare it from rational decision. A machine mind by which followers might in theory act more like us, allowing us to anticipate its moves better. Some of the suggestions can make a lot of sense, says Stuart Armstrong at the University of Oxford's Future and Humanity Institute. However, questions whether the overall approach will be effective in the end take the attempt to prevent the highly intelligent AI from improving itself. What would stop a machine from making a copy of itself that doesn't have such a constraint, says Ask Armstrong. Well, that's getting on the verge of just sheer waffle. But let's go on. Training helps us know we're wrong, by Claire Wilson. No one can be right all the time, although it turns out that we can be better at judging when we're wrong. Knowledge about the accuracy of our knowledge is a faculty called metacognition. Requiring self-awareness and introspective judgment is used in many everyday decisions. For instance, we might decide to invest money in a new venture because it seems promising, but choose not to risk much capital because we realize we might be mistaken. People naturally vary their metacognitive ability, and Stephen Fleming of the University College London wondered if these could be improved with training. His team found that this was indeed possible. A short period of training boosted metacognitive abilities, not only for the visual tasks involved, but also in the unrelated skill involving memory. Quote, it says that the training protocol might be quite general benefits for your metacognition, says Fleming. Quote, the result we are very excited by. That's the result we're very excited by. To demonstrate this, Fleming and his colleagues recruited 61 people online. They were presented with a series of paired images and asked to decide which of the pair had the brightest lines shown against the dark background. Participants were also asked to rate their confidence that each decision on a scale of 1 to 4. But half the volunteers were put in a control group. They were simply told how well they did on the brightness question. The rest were in a training group and were given feedback on the accuracy of their confidence judgment. The volunteers earned money from their answers to encourage them to return for a testing session spread over several days. After 8 sessions of 20 minutes over 2 weeks periods, the training group scores of metacognitive ability visual tasks rose from 0.74 to 0.84 on a scale of 0 to 1. Crucially, there were similar improvements in their confidence judgments on different tasks for which they received no feedback, involving trying to remember the words that they had previously been shown. In the Condorcet schools didn't improve their tasks, either task. The team is now repeating the experiment while scanning the people's brains during the task to see if the changes in ability are linked with greater activity in the brain areas known involved in recognition. Nick Young of the University of Oxford says that it's unclear if the training would improve general decision making. Quote, a reductionist view is they get good at using that scale. he says, in everyday life, people think about physicians but don't rate them on a 0 to 1 for scale. What we need to do next is to see if these benefits translate into improvements in metacognition in the real world, says Fleming. How to break up asteroids with sunlight by Leah Crane. Most small asteroids are just piles of rubble in space held together by gravity and weak molecular forces. Even a slight touch of sunlight can make them break up. Now we know how asteroids of different shapes crumble, which may help us one ever heads straight for Earth. Photons of light carry a tiny amount of momentum, which is H on lambda. So when sunlight hits the asteroid, it can send the space rock spinning in what is known as the Yardovsky-O'Keefe Yorp effect. The magnitude of the force acting on these asteroids are much like the weight of three grapes sitting on a mountain, says Motoshi Harabashi at the Alpen University in Alabama. They are negligible in the short term, but if you wait a couple of million years, these three grape forces can be significant. Harabashi and Daniel Shears of the University of Colorado use simulations to see how asteroids of various shapes would fall apart if the Yorp effect made them spin too fast. They looked at 24 real asteroids, that's smaller than 40 kilometers across, and divided them into four groups. Spheroids, elongated objects, contract boundaries, and rather ducky shapes like Comet 67B and others. Spherical asteroids tend to collapse from the center, causing them to split into lots of pieces. Elongated ones separated in the middle, or the tiniest points. And binaries break apart at the narrow connection points. The ducks think, in other words. The other bodies were more complicated, simultaneously falling apart in the middle and at the edges. Research could help protect Earth from a major asteroid strike over millions of years, I suspect. If we understand how asteroids break apart, we could potentially leverage that information. She is imparting such a touch or spin to break a killer asteroid would be much easier than smashing it up directly, said Harabashi. In brief, there's no author for this one. The beautiful luminous glow of fireflies is also a bat signal. Fireflies don't just light up their behinds to woo mates, they also do it to tell bats not to eat them. The twist of the tail is a trait that gives fireflies their name, discovered by Jesse Barber and Bose State University of Idaho and his colleagues. The glow's warming role benefits both fireflies and bats. Because these insects taste disgusting to the males, when swallowed, the chemicals emitted by fireflies cause the bats to vomit them back up. Tim placed 8 bats in a dark room with 3 or 4 fireflies, plus 3 times as many palatable insects, including beetles and moths, for 4 days. During the first night, the bats captured at least 1 firefly. By the 4th night, most bats had learned to avoid the fireflies and catch all the other prey instead. When the team painted the firefly's light organs dark, a new set of bats took twice as long to learn to avoid them. It's long been thought the firefly's bioluminescence mainly acted as a mating signal, but the new finding explains why the firefly larvae also glow despite being sexually immature. Bats don't depend on bioluminescence alone to avoid a palatable meal, Barber. His team also found that bats can use echolocation to tell fireflies apart from other insects by the speed of the beating wings. Purest water ever sheds light on dirt? No. To find out where the molecular dirt comes from, researchers have created the world's cleanest water. No matter how clean you try to make something, a thin layer of unwanted molecules always ends up on the surface. But finding its origin can be tricky. To learn more, Ulrich Delor at the Technical University of Vienna, Austria, and their colleagues worked out how a piece of titanium dioxide became dirty. Surface deposition can affect the photocatalytic activity. In the ultra-high vacuum tube, the team exposed it to various substances, including air, soda water, a carbon dioxide water mix, and arguably the world's cleanest water made by further purifying ultra-pure water. Only The air left dirt on the titanium dioxide. The smut was made from acetic and formic acid produced by plants. These chemicals are present in the air in tiny amounts. That's whoopee-doo. Tiny protein pump eats lethal poisons. Pump-like proteins embedded into the gelatinous membranes could protect against toxic nerves agents like including Novichok. Okay. As Sam said, at Pennsylvania State University and his colleagues have shown that the enzyme can catalyze the breakdown of organophosphate nerve agents created, creating a nanometer-sized pump that can both devour the nerve agent and spew out the antidote. It's hard to get my head around. Quote, the nerve agents are their food, says Sen, who presented the work at the American Chemical Society annual meeting. The enzymes could be attached to a gel particles and would be infused into clothing and used as skin ointment. Meerkats put their faith in super guards. Experience beats age or rank when it comes to how much meerkats trust those on lookout duty. Others foraging species rely on sentries who usually only pay attention to warnings from older and dominant individuals. Meerkats bury their heads in the sand and hunt for food, so having reliable lookouts is vital. They can save lives by giving an alarm call when a predator is spotted likewise. Reliable all-clear calls allow their peers to confidently resume foraging. Remote robot of Marta Mansa, University of Zurich, Switzerland, studied 9 groups of meerkats in the Kalahari Desert in South Africa. After observing each group for 3 months, they ranked the lookout as rare, common, or super. Super guards stood watch at least 50% more often than any others. Their pair recorded all clear calls from sentinels. They played them back to meerkats foraging alone. During the 544 playbacks, they monitored how much time each animal looked up to check for the predators. They found that foragers looked up at least while listening to recordings of super guards, suggesting they put most of their trust in these individuals. Parrots can invest for the future. Some parrot species can learn to make complex economic decisions. That's a finding of the early of a study involving 33 macaws of the African grey paddocks who were taught to recognise the value of different tokens that could be exchanged for a range of food rewards. The birds had to decide whether to accept an immediate reward or choose a token that would guarantee them a better snack later on. The highest reward available was a piece of walnut, while the worst was offered was a sunflower seed. The boar also had a middle option, a nugget of dry corn. In various tests, the parrots consistently rejected disappointing intermediate rewards in favour of a token, but only if it was the right one to get the better treat later. August von Bayern of the Max Planck Institute of Ornithology in Germany and her colleagues say this shows the birds can make deliberate non-profit maximizing decisions, and they can perform as well as chimpanzees and have done a similar test. The birds have been hand-reared and included 9 great green macaws, 1 pictured, 8 blue-throated macaws, 8 blue-headed macaws, and 8 African greys, which was the Norwegian blue. The great green macaw performed the best.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.